Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Shartok. In the studio today on this Medical Monday are Drs. Ira Zacon of New York Oncology Hematology and Richard Stone of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. Both are involved in New York Oncology Hematology's renowned stem cell transplant center established in 1997. The center's clinical research trial operation has played a key role in the FDA approval of over two dozen anti-cancer drugs. Dr. Zacon is director of the New York Oncology Hematology Stem Cell Transplant Program. He completed a professional development program in
autologous.
I am so sorry. I knew I'd blow it. An autologous stem cell transplantation and hematologic, whatever, malignancies at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston in 2012. He earned his medical degree and completed his internship and residency at McGill University in Montreal. He's board certified in internal medicine, medical oncology, and hematology. Dr. Richard Stone is the director of the Adult Acute Leukemia Program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, is a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. He's nationally recognized for his translational and clinical research on blood and bone marrow malignancies. He earned his medical degree from Harvard Medical School. And he's completed his internal medicine residency at Brigham Women's Hospital, and his fellowship is in hematology oncology at Dana-Farber. Dr. Zacon, Dr. Stone, two great experts. You have a great story to tell. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. So Dana-Farber, which of course is a world leader in this area, and Albany Med and your group, have gotten together so that they can do something together. So if somebody comes in, they don't have to travel to Boston every single time. They can go to Boston, but they can be treated here. And so New York Oncology and Hematology has teamed up. Who wants to go first? Dr. Zacon, would you like to sort of tell us what you know?
Sure. Well, for many of our patients who have different blood cancers, such as leukemias, often there may be a need for them to access an outside opinion, to see an expert who maybe is solely dedicated to the research and patient care of leukemias, let's say, for example, and as well as maybe some specialized care, such as bone marrow transplant. And those patients, we may then connect them to colleague specialists at the Dana-Farber, and then work together. We call it shared care. And for us, this involves, you know, a few things. One is that those of us at NYOH specializing in the blood cancers, we've developed these relationships with the blood cancer section at the Dana-Farber. We spend time there in order to not, you know, to augment our knowledge. And
So you go over there?
Well, we have, for at certain times, and may continue to do so. And then we also share in research trials together through what's called the Blood Cancer Research Partnership, which is centered at Dana-Farber but connected to practices like ours out in the community. And then for our patients, I think the beauty is that they can have almost seamless care between the two institutions. Whether they're here in our area or they're traveling to Boston, there's a loop of communication between us that allows them to, almost in real time sometimes, when you're just on email seeing patients, that they feel this connectivity, which gives them great security and confidence in their care. And even if they're sick and maybe need to come into hospital, if we admit them to the hospital, we'll be evaluating them, we'll be caring for them, but we immediately connect into their specialists at Dana-Farber as well, who are part of, then, of their loop of care. And so I think this has benefited greatly, the patients who come from this region to access the excellence that's available at an institution at Dana-Farber, but spend more of their time, at home with family. That's been a wonderful part of it.
Dr. Richard Stone, you came all the way over here. We're very grateful. Tell us a little bit about your perspective on this. And you, of course, are Dana-Farber.
Exactly. Well, it's a great honor to work at a place like Dana-Farber, which is a federally funded cancer center. And one of our missions is to improve the cancer health of people in our catchment area. That was the whole point of the federal war on cancer that began in the Nixon administration. And we can't think of a better way to complete part of that mission than to team up with people like Dr. Zacon and all the great doctors in his practice to try to transmit the sort of unique perspective we have on cancer, being able to marshal all facets of cancer care from the basic science to the translational science, epidemiology, palliative care, you name it. That's what federally funded cancer centers are all about. And we are dedicated to decreasing the burden of cancer in the population and optimal treatment of patients who do get cancer in our catchment area. And the relationships we've been able to develop with New York Oncology Hematology have been fantastic. It's very rewarding for us at the Farber to work with people in the community who we know are giving frontline care to many patients, and very rewarding for us to see some of those patients when they have care that can only be delivered at the Dana-Farber or need an opinion that we have the luxury of being very specialized. Some of us are specialized in just one type of blood cancer, let alone all the blood cancers. So it's really a great partnership, and I think the ultimate goal of reducing the cost of cancer care and improving the outcomes of people with cancer is served well by this partnership.
Yeah. Dr. Zacon, you are happy with the way it works, because you have to really work hard at making this relationship work, don't you?
Well, it starts with building the relationships. You have to build a level of trust. They need to know that they can count on us to care for their patients that are our patients. So it begins with that kind of foundation. And then it's just using the technology that's available to us, to be in such ease of communicating to the benefit of our patients. And probably this may eventually evolve into the world of telemedicine, where you will actually be able to video stream connectivity, for patients to see Dr. Stone, at a distance and interact directly. That's something that we can see evolving.
Huh. Okay, we have a lot of people on the phone. We only have one phone that is free right now, 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Ron in Hyde Park. Ron, we're going to keep these calls as short as we can so that we can get everybody else in. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay, thanks for the opportunity. Sure. 2008, I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. I went to Sloan. I had 8 sessions of R-CHOP. Everything was fine. About 2 years ago, I had gone to see my ENT for just some other stuff. I had a series of ENT problems. She did a scope, went in through my nose, and said, something here. Anyway, to make a long story short, I went back. They did a biopsy and found some Reed-Sternberg cells in my nasal pharynx. Cut to the chase, they had finally done another PET scan and said, nope, turned out to be an asymmetrical sphenoid sinus that she thought was some kind of tumor because it was bulging out. But my question is it always the case as a precursor to Reed-Sternberg to Hodgkin's, or could there be other reasons to have those cells?
Okay, and we're going to ask the docs, what is Reed-Sternberg?
Well, Reed-Sternberg is a type of cell that's a cell of origin of Hodgkin's lymphoma. We divide these immune lymphomas into Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's. Hodgkin's has the Reed-Sternberg cells, named after some old-time pathologists. Pretty much most types of Hodgkin's disease have a Reed-Sternberg cell. Very important to pathologists to be able to define that. So if you see a Reed-Sternberg cell and you're sure it's a Reed-Sternberg cell, it's probably Hodgkin's lymphoma.
And which is the one you want less, non-Hodgkin's or Hodgkin's lymphoma?
I don't think you want either of them, but both of them are highly curable. And in fact, that just brings up one little point about Hodgkin's lymphoma, is that the Dana-Farber, led by Dr. Philippe Armand, has recently published a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine talking about a way we can unleash the immune system with what's called an immune checkpoint blocker to augment anti-tumor activity of our chemotherapy. And in fact, the drug works as well as a single agent. So this is a good example of how we can help people with Hodgkin's disease who aren't doing so well. Most do very well, but some don't, and we can help them with new medicines.
Ron, I thank you for your call. Okay, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
support comes from Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery. 518-432-0358. Healthy Endeavors Medicine, Gilderland, New York. Offering personalized functional medicine evaluations and care, including endopat testing, non-invasive assessment of blood vessels and heart. 518-355-2060. Beacon Arts, inviting listeners to September's second Saturday in Beacon. Special events, gallery openings, artist receptions, tastings, kids welcome. Many shops open until 9, Saturday, September 12th. BeaconArts.org. And from Ward's Nursery and Garden Center, Great Barrington. For hardy mums, long-blooming perennials and shrubs, ornamental grasses, shade trees, and garden supplies, wardsnursery.com.
And the phones are just loaded, folks. Actually, there's one free phone right now. So we will go to Jim from Matamoros. Welcome back, Jim.
Thanks. How common is aplastic anemia due to the use of chloramphenicol or other antibiotics?
Well, so for the audience out there, aplastic anemia is a condition where the bone marrow, which makes the blood, is very underproductive. It's can't make the blood cells adequately, so you have low blood counts like anemia. There are different causes of it. The caller here, Jim, is mentioning an antibiotic called chloramphenicol, which is no longer used, but had an association with having a kind of a toxic effect on the bone marrow.
Interesting.
More commonly is really an autoimmune phenomenon where our own immune system is suppressing our own bone marrow.
And do we know why that happens?
Well, most often we don't really know what the trigger is. I mean, there's other things that can be toxic to the bone marrow that can cause an aplastic anemia. If you had radiation exposures that were, mm-hmm. you know, severe, you could have end up with a bone marrow that's like that. Mm. But no, we don't know the cause. But the way we treat it is primarily trying to suppress this overactive immune system to stop doing what it's doing and allow the normal bone marrow to begin to replenish and produce the blood counts. And if that's not effective, then ultimately we need to do what's called a bone marrow transplant, which is to give that patient bone marrow from a donor. And
how does that work?
Rich, you might want to speak to that.
Very effectively. If we need to use stem cell transplant, which is what we say now instead of bone marrow transplant, if we can remember to do that, is very effective for aplastic anemia with very high cure rates approaching 80%.
Yeah. Good. Okay, thank you very much, Jim. All right, let's go to Bill in Canajoharie. Okay, Bill, you're in Canajoharie and you're up.
Hello. A friend of mine has a ductal carcinoma in situ. One side is spotty, the other side has some gnarly masses, and I'm wondering what is the most promising treatment for that.
Okay, well, Bill, if I understand, you're probably referring to what's called ductal carcinoma in situ of the breast in women.
Yes, yes.
So this refers to kind of the early development of cancer cells in the milk ducts.
Oh, okay.
And it is not yet kind of growing to invade into the breast tissue where the breast cancer cells may begin to spread, and that's when it becomes a true breast cancer and more serious. The treatment of it is to try and still remove the tissue of the breast that has this early breast cancer, and then most often you give some radiation to the area because we always worry about little bits of these microscopic cancer cells that we can't see when the surgeon removes them, and that is very highly likely to cure the disease, but that particular woman, of course, still needs to have ongoing screening the rest of her life to detect any breast cancer that could develop, because she's shown that, okay, she has some, breast tissue that's prone to that.
And Dr. Stone?
I totally agree with that. There may be some new thoughts about ways to approach ductal carcinoma in situ with maybe less aggressive treatment than even what Ira mentioned.
Yep.
So we'll have to follow that literature very closely.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah. Okay, and now we'll go to Colin in Kingston. Okay, Colin, you're on.
Yes, hi, thank you. About 3.5 years ago, my wife had a spinal cord injury. And 2 years ago,
She was diagnosed with stage 3 throat cancer, and 1 year ago, she was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer. And I'm just wondering if the doctors think that, you know, such an insult to the body as a spinal cord injury could make you susceptible to cancer.
Well, I'm very sorry your wife has all those problems, but as far as we know, there's no relationship between spinal cord injury and those type of cancers.
So it's sort of coincidental.
It seems to be. Yeah. Would you agree, Ira?
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, breast cancer is just too common, you know, in our society. And so there really isn't such an association. And throat cancers can occur for different reasons, depending on where they're located. Sometimes it's related to smoking history, certain viruses.
She never smoked,
yeah.
But we were told actually it was probably HPV.
Right.
Didn't take enough cells during the biopsy to run that test.
Right. This virus called HPV, or human papillomavirus, which, you know, we can be exposed to. Fortunately, those cancers, which typically are around the area of the tonsil, they actually do better than the smoking-related ones. And so hopefully, if it's more localized, can have a pretty good cure rate.
She seems to have recovered well from both of the cancers. We're just, you know, we're at the point where every time she goes in for any kind of a test, we're just terrified.
Sure.
And I was just wondering if there's any connection, and I'm glad to hear that you think there is not.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. It's interesting. Let's go to Joseph in Rotterdam. Okay, Joseph in Rotterdam, you're on.
Hi, I would like to know if hormone replacement therapy increases cancer risk.
Well, hormone replacement in women, such as giving estrogens to alleviate menopause symptoms or to help promote bone health, does have some increased risk for breast cancer. And it is not usually used in the same way that it had been in the past. So if that's the question related to that kind of hormone replacement, it can. And a woman has to have a very informed discussion with their primary care doctor or gynecologist as to the pros and cons and why it's being indicated. But it's not meant to be used long term if it is.
Right. And in a male's, testosterone replacement therapy could potentiate prostate cancer. So it should not be used, obviously, in people that have prostate cancer, because we usually remove testosterone from such patients.
Hmm. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Joseph. Let's go to Delia. Okay, in Saratoga Springs. Delia, you're on.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, I'd like to get some comments on the intriguing association between multiple myeloma and various skin diseases.
Hmm. Well, what do you mean?
Well, I've been told by my specialist, my dermatology specialist at Mass in Boston, mm-hmm. Mass General, that skin lesions and skin diseases are often associated, not often, but can be associated with multiple myeloma, and I have both.
Okay.
And this is also apparently in association with Lyme disease also, so it's a bit complicated.
Okay.
But I can't imagine how the mechanism for how skin problems relate to bone cancer, blood cancer. Sorry.
Yeah. So there's not necessarily a very strong occurrence of skin lesions or skin rashes or lesions in association with multiple myeloma. Myeloma, again, for the audience, is a form of bone marrow cancer that involves different immune system cells. But sometimes when you have immune system cancers, you can get an autoimmune, phenomenon where skin rashes may be part of that. And then there's an uncommon subtype of myeloma. We call it POM syndrome, which skin changes are actually part of that's the S in POMs. So a dermatologist has to be very knowledgeable about seeing certain skin lesions to be able to think that maybe that's associated with myeloma, because then a hematologist like ourselves would be evaluating to see if that's an association. But that particular syndrome is fairly rare.
Dr. Stone?
I agree. It's possible also that the therapy for myeloma or having myeloma itself could actually suppress the immune system, which sometimes increases the risk for other cancers because we depend to a certain extent on our normal immune system to surveil or find cancers when they're very early and get rid of them. That's why some people do get increased risk of cancers if their immune system is not working right. In fact, lymphoma can be a consequence of that. So it's possible with myeloma, sometimes the immunoglobulin levels are low because of the problem with the B cells, that the immune cells that can lead to other cancers. But it's pretty unusual.
Okay. Yeah, my skin lesions are not cancerous, but I got them first. And because of them, I had to go hunting for the myeloma and finally found it.
Yeah, so, it is possible, but not common.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. For the first time, there are three free phones. That's amazing. And that hasn't happened all program so far, so if you want to call, now's a good time to do it. 1-800-348-2551. Get in line, and we'll take you as soon as we can. Okay, let's go to Susan in Poughkeepsie. Susan.
Hi there. I have a granddaughter who's 5 years old, and 4 months ago, she was diagnosed with B-cell lymphoblastic lymphoma. And soon after she started her chemo, she was in remission and continues to be, but will be on chemo for 2 years. So I just wanted to know if you could talk about that. The fact that cancer is being cured, but it takes so long for it to actually hold and the effects of chemo take such a toll on a child.
Well, that's a great question, and I hope and pray your granddaughter will do very well. She should, because as most people know, leukemias and lymphoblastic lymphomas, a very close cousin to leukemia, are extremely curable in young people, i.e. children. So obviously I don't know the details of her case, but she should do very well. Your question about late effects of chemotherapy in children is a very important one. And our pediatric oncology colleagues have been studying this very closely for years. They've actually been able to, in some cases, remove therapy or take away types of chemotherapy that used to be used routinely in patients that have a good prognosis. But it is very important to monitor patients who've undergone chemotherapy at any age, particularly a young age, for late effects on the nervous system, the cardiovascular system, and the endocrine system, to name several. Fortunately, with excellent post care, which we call survivorship care, which is a major issue right now in adults and kids who get cancer and then are cured, we think she'll do very well, and hopefully her late side effects will be minimized, but I'm sure her doctors will use just enough therapy to cure her cancer and not any extra that might affect her adversely down the road.
Susan, thanks for the call. Let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, what's your question?
Oh, it's kind of a two-part question. One is, I had a friend who worked for Sloan Kettering in the research department, cancer research, and she eventually left because we disappeared.
I'm sorry, we didn't hear that, Howard. And I think we really have to be very careful about talking about institutions. And
why is that?
Well, because sometimes when somebody calls and says something, it's not fair.
You're talking about lawsuits.
What'd you say?
You're talking about lawsuits type of thing?
Well, I'm talking about playing fair. I'm talking about making sure that it's not hearsay.
All right. Yeah. Scratch that from the record where she was working. But
okay,
anyway, she would eventually quit because every time they're getting close to something as far as actually curing cancer, not a 5-year, what they call a cure, it would disappear. They would kind of shove it off to the side. And it's amazing to me how there's still this suppression of unorthodox methods for curing cancer. It's been going on for 100 years, over and over and over again. Same treatments over and over and over again that don't work. So I just wanted to lay that out there.
Okay, and so you've done it. Okay, gentlemen, anybody want to have anything to say about this?
Well, I think there's a unfortunate perception that somehow the cure for cancer is being suppressed. God, that's not true. We work in day and night to find cures for every different cancer and its subtype. So this is a sad sort of urban or
myth,
rural legend. I don't know. There's no basis for it that I'm aware of.
Ira?
I would also say that if you look at what's happening in the world of cancer therapies, It is remarkable what's happening. And this is all the fruits of the hard work of scientists who have been studying cancer and different cancers and uncovering the mechanisms of what is going inside these cancer cells, what are the genetic changes. And now we're beginning to see therapies that target these therapies, and they're so much better than some of the previous therapies we've used. We are also now emerging into an age of harnessing the power of our own immune system to fight our cancers. And that's all still in research. There's some therapies that are lower. We're seeing some successes, and that's the promise of the future. And I think we're leaving that now.
Can I add a little something to that?
All right, go ahead.
I had a doctor many years ago. His name is Emmanuel Ravisi. He was a medical doctor. He spoke 11 languages. He was, I put him on a genius line.
Okay, what do you got? Go ahead.
He came up with all kinds of therapies for cancer using your own immune system, and they all almost put him in jail. They sued him for everything he had. They sent a bomb squad to his office saying that he had dangerous chemicals in his laboratory, which he's been using for 20 years out of a catalog. And there was this kind of harassment all the time.
Okay, so what's your question?
No, I just want to state that.
Okay, once again.
This is nothing new. To get the immune system to fight cancer. It's been around for a long time. It's been suppressed all this time.
Thank you, Howard. I doubt it's been suppressed, but what can I tell you? All right. Gentlemen, anybody want to react to that? Or no, that's enough. All right. Let's go to Vicki in Albany. Vicki, you're on.
Hello. Thank you. And I would like to know the reason for a low ferritin level, while other blood levels are excellent, and... is taking iron, those are two questions, is taking iron sufficient to correct that? It's a ferritin level of about 17.
Somebody's going to define the ferritin level for me.
Sure. Yeah. So ferritin is a protein that stores iron in our body. And if you have a low ferritin, then by definition, that is iron deficiency. You don't have enough iron. And so it is appropriate to take iron. Now, most often with iron deficiency, there is anemia, which means the red blood cells are low, and they typically are smaller in size. But it is possible to have iron deficiency without yet showing anemia, although inevitably it would develop.
Okay.
Okay. The hemoglobin is fine, and all of the other heme levels are excellent. That's why I'm questioning just the ferritin. Okay.
Yeah, it's a very reliable test.
My question.
Yeah. Iris said it's a very reliable test.
Okay. So taking iron is sufficient without doing something negative to the other heme levels.
No, you're just replacing the iron, but it's important for your doctor to ask why you're iron deficient, because there's different reasons, and it's always important not only to recognize iron deficiency, but why, because there can be important things that need to be discovered.
Can you explain
about that.
Some of those?
In women who are pre-menopause, that may relate to very heavy menstrual bleeding. In men and in women post-menopause, we worry about silent blood loss, typically from the gastrointestinal tract. And some people just don't absorb their iron very well for a variety of reasons. But it's certainly very important to make sure that we understand the reason, because that can include cancers of the gastrointestinal tract, and you certainly want to pick those up early.
Thank you very much for
your answers. Bye-bye.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551, two free phones, and we will go to nowhere. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Shannon Rose Design, Saratoga Springs, New York, working to help companies and organizations express their identities through corporate branding, web design and development, and graphic design for almost three decades. ShannonRose.com. Ellis Medicine, a community healthcare system providing cardiac, stroke, cancer, and emergency care. EllisMedicine.org. CSEA, New York's leading union for more than a century. And from Tierra Farm Retail Store, Madison Avenue, Albany, organic nuts, dried fruit, fair trade coffee, and chocolate, granola and nut butters, now serving SoCo ice cream, tierrafarm.com.
And we are back. We've got two wonderful doctors with us. Dr. Richard Stone, director of the Adult Acute Leukemia Program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. Ira Zakon of New York Oncology Hematology. And they're both here answering your questions. The phones have been pretty well lit up. There is one little free phone right now, and we're coming around the corner here. Let's go to Richard in Whitesboro. Okay, Richard, you're on.
Okay, thanks. Excellent program and excellent service. I had a question about thrombocyte count. My neurologist discovered that I have a fluctuating count going from 126 to up to normal over the past several years. And he hasn't said anything about checking it out, but I was just wondering if you have a recommendation. I looked up on the net, and it said that the only thing I'm taking is Pepcid, which sometimes affects it.
Dr. Stone?
Well, if you're talking about disorders of the thrombocyte count, commonly known as the platelet count, these are the cells that we have in our blood that are prevent bleeding, sort of the molecular glue or the cellular glue. And there's only, if your platelet count is a bit below normal, there's only really two ways that can happen. Either you're not making enough platelets in your bone marrow, or you're destroying them prematurely. However, the good news is, if your platelet count isn't going down, down and down and down, if it's just fluctuating, there's probably nothing serious going on. Sometimes people have a low level of autoantibodies. These are antibodies you make that can destroy your own platelets a little bit. But if it's fluctuating, probably not a big deal. I wouldn't even worry about the Pepcid. So I think it'll be okay.
Oh, very good.
Thanks very much. And while I'm at it, when every once in a while we go to the doc and they give us the standard series of stuff, you got a blood test you got to go get. And sometimes it says your red blood cell count is a little low. Sometimes it says your red blood cell count is a little high. And then you go for a retest and it's normal. What's that all about?
Well, just like with our last caller, there can be some random fluctuations, usually not significant. I'm more concerned about trends, either in the upward or downward direction.
Right.
So there are, you know, and not every slightly different value is biologically different. If your hematocrit is 42 one day and 40 the next day, it's probably not biologically significant. So we've got to be careful of paying too much attention to random fluctuations. More important to watch for trends.
That's why you'll see, you know, your primary doctor repeating a test, because you don't rely on one test. You want to see a trend. Okay, this is something to pay attention to, or no, this is not something to be concerned about.
Now, can the labs get it wrong?
There can sometimes be a technical problem with how the blood sample was handled, getting to the lab, how it's processed. Sometimes that'll stand out to the doctor. They'll realize it just doesn't make sense. But anything like that, you know, you don't rely on one test result, especially if it's not fitting with your patient. If they're feeling well, then you would repeat the test and make sure there's a consistent issue to address.
So I once went to a doctor. He sent me for a blood test. It was high. The red blood, I think, it was high or low, whatever. And I went back and I said, the doctor wants a retest. And she said, oh, he's always sending people for a retest. That probably told me more about the lab than I wanted to know. Anyway, you had to be there to get it. Let's go to Eli. All right, Eli, you're on. Eli.
Yes.
Go ahead. What do you want?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Okay. I have a small smokehouse where we make poultry, sausages, and deli meats. Mm-hmm. And we've been having a long-standing argument between my father and myself and my staff about using nitrites or not using nitrites. And, you know, so till now we've been just selling retail. We don't use any nitrites. We sell everything frozen. But now we're trying to get into the market. And the only way to really do that is by using nitrites. I would like to hear from a professional perspective, what do you feel about nitrites? Because what they say now is that it's a proven carcinogen. Is there any new studies on it? Is that still the common belief?
So being a specialist in the blood cancers, I'm not sure I could be up to date in answering that. And it's partly a question of cancer, what we call epidemiology, causes of cancer. Nitrates do have an association that I recall certainly for stomach cancers in particular, of the cancers of the organ of the stomach that receives our food, and cured meats processed that way, have had nitrate content. Of course, it's not the only cause of stomach cancer. There's bacteria that live in our stomach that can contribute to stomach cancer, and there can be other contributors. But I couldn't really comment on the industry and where nitrates are at in terms of regulation or how you should approach that as a smoker.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like okay. The meat's delicious.
It is.
Yeah, nitrates in Japan, as Ira said, nitrates have been linked to esophageal and stomach cancer, particularly the latter. But in the U.S., there's really not much of an epidemiological question, and they're, smoked meats are not banned, so I think you're okay.
I always tell my patients, when we're not sure, moderation. So a moderate meat intake, including smoked meats, and we're getting hungry here talking to you.
I kind of feel that way. Just about too much of anything is not good for us.
How about you hear something negative, and instead of moderation, my wife's position on all things, how about doing nothing, never having bacon again? So, all right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to be able to put what I make in a position where, with moderation, it doesn't harm anybody.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate your call.
All right. Thank you so much for your butt.
Bye.
Have a good day.
Yeah, bye. Let's go to Anitra. Okay, Anitra, you're on.
Oh, great. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a friend who has a rare form of breast cancer that never showed up in her breast, but went straight to her gallbladder. And when they did exploratory surgery, it was like riddled with cancer. They took that out. She was okay for a year and a half and then started going downhill. And they found that it had migrated to her bone marrow, and that her bone marrow was 85% cancer cells. She is she's on chemo for 6 months now. No one ever talks to her about the outlook. I mean, to me, it sounds very bad. So I have two questions. I mean, just hearing that, breast cancer cells in the bone marrow and 85% of it, and, they're trying to treat it and, to kind of change that. But what would the outlook be for that? I mean, if you heard that at a dinner party or something, when you go like, oh, God, she probably doesn't have long, or no, they actually can have good treatments for that. And
okay, so I'm sorry to interrupt, Anitra, but we really have a long line here and very few minutes left. What's the question?
So the question is, if they heard that, what would they think the outlook would be? And part two is, when you have a friend who you think really has a poor outlook, what's the best way to support them?
Well, I'll take the first part of the question is really requires more knowledge about the patient's case.
Sure.
And sometimes breast cancer can be almost a chronic disease, even with some of the dire issues you mentioned. But I'd like to really harp in on the second question, because that's really what we're all about as oncologists, supporting people. It's not just about giving them chemotherapy, immune therapy. It's about taking care of them as whole people. And we, all of us, believe very strongly in that. And we rely on the families and the friends of the patients to support them. What I try to find out, and I'm sure Ira is no different, is what's really important to the patient. I encourage you to read Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal.
Read that. It's
so
incredible.
That should have been that I'm sure will give you some good ideas about how to support your friend.
Yeah, and I think it's just knowing that you're there for them and that you're showing that you're there for them is probably the most important thing. They may let you know what they want from you or what they want to share. Sometimes patients don't want to be, have too many people calling and asking how they are and how they're doing. And there's some kind of balance between those. But I think even silently, you don't always know what to say, but the fact that you're there is most meaningful to that person.
Absolutely. Thank you for that call. Let's go to Paul in Saugerties. Paul in Saugerties, you're on.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I would like some feedback on my situation. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2001. I had 23 radiation treatments and 70 palladium seeds implanted. At the time, my Gleason score was 7. It was a 4 plus 3, which I understand is fairly aggressive. 4 years later, my PSA went back up to 10. They put me on Trelstar for a year, which knocked it back to 0. Another 4 or 5 years went by, and my PSA went up to 22. They put me on Lupron for a year. And just last January, my PSA was up to 50.2, and now I'm in the midst of another round, a year of radiation, or not radiation, Lupron treatment. My question is, I'm being seen at Sloan Kettering in Manhattan. I fly up in the wintertime for quarterly appointments, and I live here from Florida, and I live here in the summer, so it's easy to get there. I want to know why does it keep coming back? Because I have friends who just had hormone therapy, and theirs disappeared. Mine keeps coming back. And what is the potential for metastasis, and what do the doctors think my general prognosis is going to be? I was 58 when I was first diagnosed. I'm 72 now.
Well, I think, thank goodness for that. You've shown how long someone can live with prostate cancer.
I get good treatment, I must say.
Yeah, and not knowing all the details short of what you shared, the prostate cancer can be a very chronic disease, and even when it's detectable, because the PSA is a detectable test, it tells us that there's some prostate cancer, even if we don't see it,
right.
That you can continue to treat it. And what you've been receiving is kind of the mainstay of therapy, which Dr. Stone had mentioned earlier, which is some way of depriving the prostate cancer cells from testosterone or male hormone.
Right, the fertilizer for prostate cancer.
Right, but then there's other treatments beyond that. There are certain chemotherapies that can be effective and are showing, even in combination with hormones, that can improve things. Other patients receive hormone therapy for a shorter course after they've had a prostatectomy or radiation, and they may be cured in the end with that. And so that's a different situation than when it's coming back afterwards.
I understand that after you've had radiation treatment, you're not eligible for a radical prostatectomy. Is that correct?
You know, not being in the field, I wouldn't want to answer that 100%. It can certainly be very complicated to do a prostatectomy after radiation, especially after a number of years.
And the other protocol that's being looked at by Sloan, and I understand other places, is not to just put you on androgen deprivation therapy for a year, but to keep you on it forever. And I'm afraid of that because, well, when I was 58, that was fine. I had enough energy. But now that I'm 72 and in the midst of Lupron treatments, injections, I get 30 milligrams every 3 months, I must say I am very fatigued all the time, and I'm not looking forward to being like this forever. So I just wanted to know.
Okay,
my doctor at Sloan says I give him my concerns, and he's very reassuring. He says we'll manage it. We'll manage it. But I worry about the future.
Okay, Paul, we have to sort of cut it off there. Gentlemen, anybody, something fast? No. Okay, Paul, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it very much. Okay, let's go to Christine in Pittsfield. Christine, you're on.
Hi. I was diagnosed with essential thrombocythemia about 6 years ago, and I've been treated with hydroxyurea for about that length of time. And on a couple of occasions, I've had skin ulcers around my ankles in relation to the hydroxyurea. And I was tried on Agrolin, but have an allergic reaction to that. And I don't want to do interferon injections. So my question is, are you aware of any other treatments for this ET?
Sure. Well, that's a disease I see quite a number of patients with. But Obviously, I don't know your specific details, but there are other things you that can be tried by your doctors. Depending on the molecular biology of disease, one could even consider a new drug called ruxolitinib or Jakafi.
What is that drug?
Jakafi is the trade name. Ruxolitinib is the generic name. It's a JAK2 inhibitor that might have some role.
What? Just give him the trade name.
Jakafi. J-A-K-E-F-I.
J-E-K-E-F-I.
Yeah,
okay.
I might have spelled it wrong. But then again, I could spell the long name, but I'm not going to bother doing that.
Okay.
But anyway, that's one thing that could be tried. There's also other chemotherapy drugs like busulfan that have been occasionally tried. But the good news is essential thrombocytosis is a disease that people can live with. Generally speaking, the natural history is very similar to that of age-matched controls, which means people don't die of it, which is a great thing to know.
Right.
I would also reassure you that interferon in that condition is generally at a low dose, and many patients actually don't have as much of the side effects that they may associate if they've read about interferon. So it depends on what's the right choice, and it's something you should discuss with your hematologist.
Okay, thanks so much. All right, let's go to Carl in Skodak. Carl, you're on.
Hi, folks. Question is very simple. I'm lucky I'm a bladder cancer survivor, but at the time I was seen by NYLOH and a number of surgical groups, so we decided on radical surgery. The question is prognosis long-term. I have urostomy, so, and I, at least based on the note assessments, everything was clear. Long-term prognosis of reoccurrence.
Well, again, it's very difficult to answer that not being really part of your care and knowing the details of your initial bladder cancer. But the more localized it is, and if it did not spread into lymph nodes, as you mentioned, that's all very positive. That means the chance of cure is greater, and so that we would be very hopeful, in fact, for you.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Nope. Thank you very much. Okay, and now we have Kathy in East Chatham. Kathy?
Yes, I had DNA testing that said I was positive for one copy of the H63D mutation, negative for the C282Y1. What's the next step? I have an appointment, but what could that mean, and what could happen?
Well, your doctor is screening you for a disease called hereditary hemochromatosis.
Yes.
Which is a disease where the iron can build up in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, which one of those mutations is critically important? Why did you get that done in the first place?
Because I had a blood test. RBC was high, not out of the ballpark, but high, and the HCT and the HGB were high. But again, not outrageously high, but sort of on the outer limits of the range.
Usually that test is done when your ferritin, Dr. Zakin was talking about earlier, is high and you have a high iron. If your hemoglobin's high, then that's important to think about issues of the bone marrow being a little overheated and making too many red cells. So that's something to talk about with your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Is he worried about iron overload, or is he worried about too high on the hematocrit, which would make you think about some other things?
Right. But I will say this gene mutations that you're mentioning related to hemochromatosis, they're very common in our society, especially in Caucasians.
Mm-hmm.
And just having one of those genes, especially the one you describe, is not clearly associated with hemochromatosis, especially only one of the mutations, but you carry it, and there's a 50%
mm-hmm.
chance that that can be passed on to any children.
Kathy,
mm-hmm.
got to go. Thank you
okay,
very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Gentlemen, there certainly has to come a point at which we're going to do gene splicing. We're going to say you have an extra one. We're going to take one away. You have an extra. I mean, how long can it be before we start to do that?
Well, we're already doing that in terms
exactly.
of small molecules which can inhibit mutated genes.
Mm-hmm.
We will be doing gene therapy. We'll be doing CRISPR, which is a way to annotate the genetic code. So there's a lot of things we can do. It's all coming down the pike.
Great. I wish I could go further. We're about out of time. Thanks for everybody. I'd also like to thank Dr. Ira Zakin and Dr. Richard Stone for joining us today. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Urological Institute, Urologic Oncology Services, prostate cancer specialists providing comprehensive care for all stages of prostate cancer, featuring 3D diagnostic imaging and advanced robotics, urologyoncology.com. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.